Welcome to Gruesomely Gorgeous. I'm your host, Taylor Wells. Joining me, my fellow narrator, Crystal Nail. All of our stories are researched by our criminal justice expert, Caitlin Brandt. Together, we are Gruesomely Gorgeous.
Good evening, all you gorgeously gruesome ghoulies and ghouls. It's Crystal here, and today I'd like to talk to you about three young men who died entombed in the USS West Virginia during Pearl Harbor. When Nathan and Jane Olds of Stanton, Ralph and Vera Edcott of Aberdeen, and Effie Costin of Henryville were informed by the U.S. Navy in December of 1941 that each of their families had lost a son during the Japanese Pearl Harbor bombing, they were heartbroken. Clifford Olds, 20, Ronald Edcott, 18, and Lewis Buddy Costin, 21, had been sailors on the battleship USS West Virginia, which had been hit by a series of torpedoes and bombs. The telegrams merely stated that the three young men died at their duty station. But was this the truth? Harlan Costin, the younger brother of Buddy, found out in 1942 when a chance meeting with a crew member of the now refloated West Virginia told a sad tale that by now has become legend. It was the story of three young men who had survived for what must have been 16 hellish days in the dark pump room of a battleship sitting at the bottom of Pearl Harbor. Costin, Olds, and Edcott had not died easily or willingly, as attested to by witnesses who remember. The banging was worse at night, said Marine Corps Dick Fisk. You'd hear bang, 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 then stop, then bang, bang, bang from deep in the bow of the ship. It didn't take long to realize that men were making that noise. To this day, Fisk chokes up when he tells the story. Pretty soon, nobody wanted to be on guard duty, especially at night when it was quiet. The noises didn't stop until Christmas Eve. Bob Kronberger, who was a crewman on the USS West Virginia, says he knew all three of the young sailors. I didn't know them well because I was a higher rank and couldn't fraternize, but it was an awful way to die. Kronberger is a good example of the fortunes of war. His brother and father were also part of the West Virginia crew. All three survived the attack. It was not hard for Harlan Costin to make the decision not to tell his family about the true circumstances of Buddy's death. His family had already suffered so much when a younger brother had died of an infectious disease. The father had died in a fight. To tell his mother how Buddy must have suffered might have been too much for her to bear. He kept this secret until the 1990s, when newspapers began to report the story. Duke Olds found out about his brother's struggle to live from a relative who worked at the shipyard in Bremerton, Washington, where the USS West Virginia had been taken for repairs. Olds told his brother and two sisters, but not his parents. It would have been really hard on my father. He and Cliff were real close. It was best to let it be. It would be many years before Duke would find out what he thought had been a well-kept secret had been revealed to his mother not long before she died. They said she took it really hard. Jack Miller, A buddy of Clifford Olds said he knew his friend was one of those making the noise that was coming from the bow section. Clifford had often invited him into the pump room for conversation. Just for laughs, they would close the hatch and scream all manner of epithets in the airtight space, knowing no one on the outside could hear them. The night before the attack, Cliff, he, and another buddy had gone to a Honolulu night spot together. They had said no thanks to a barmaid who had taken their picture and offered to sell it to them. Miller could not know the Mario would change their lives forever and how much that photo would come to mean. Ronald Edcott had joined the Navy Reserve at age 17, mainly because he wanted to emulate his father, who had served earlier. He had been on active duty for 10 months when the Japanese rained death on the ship, and he found himself entombed in a pump room, A-109, with Olds and Coston. Velma Lawrence, now of California, was Edcott's childhood sweetheart and says his parents left Aberdeen in 1956. She knows they never knew how their son died. No doubt the main reason for the state of anguish among the sailors topside stemmed from the fact that they knew rescue was impossible. Olds, Coston, and Edcott were sitting at the bottom of Pearl Harbor, surrounded by water. The ship's commander, Captain Mervyn S. Benin, had been killed in the early moments of the attack, but quick thinking by a young lieutenant who was also the fire control officer ensured the West Virginia would sink on an even keel. It is somewhat ironic that the three men were doomed. The young officer's actions saved hundreds but ensured their deaths had the weavy. As the ship was affectionately known, capsized like the battleship USS Oklahoma, the three had might been rescued by cutting through the hull. Not that the rescue had been guaranteed, as the Oklahoma rescuers discovered. Many men on that ship died of asphyxiation when air rushed out as soon as the hull was breached. Those topside on the Weavy also known that rescue from below the waterline by drilling a hole through the hull would result in a blowout, killing the diver. Added to this was the realization that the United States had been plunged into war, and many things had taken precedence over three enlisted men at the bottom of Pearl. Those above knew it was not a question of whether Olds, Coston, and Edcott could be rescued. It was only a question of how long they would last. The three entombed young men, who had only 3 years of service between them, probably did not know that they were doomed. They wanted to live, and they had more on their side than their comrades knew. They had emergency food rations, access to the freshwater compartment, flashlights to enable them to see, and two other things. An 8-day clock and a calendar. And so they banged. At the end of each 24 period, they marked their calendar. No doubt they wondered, does anybody up there hear us? They were heard, but nothing could be done. The brass probably saw them as they did all the dead men below. They could not be helped. So efforts were concentrated on the living. Despite all the remembrance, the stories of the three trapped sailors might never have been released to the public without the salvage report filed by Commander Paul Dice during body retrieval efforts in May of 1942. While many of the 106 deaths on the USS West Virginia were from drowning when compartment hatches had to be closed on those trying to escape, Dice immediately noticed that the pump room A-109 was completely dry. Three bodies were found huddled together on the storeroom shelf. Then Dice saw flashlights and batteries strewn out, along with empty food ration. The manhole covered to the freshwater tanks had been removed. Then salvage workers saw the 8-day clock and the calendar with a red X marked through each day through December 23rd. With this discovery, grown men broke down in tears. Dice's official report is matter of fact and devoid of emotion. Three bodies were found on the shelf of storeroom A111, clad in blue and jerseys. The storeroom was open to a freshwater pump, A109, which was apparently the battle station assigned to these men. The emergency rations at the station had been consumed and the manhole cover to the freshwater tanks had been removed. A calendar which was found in the compartment had an X marked through each day from December 7th of 1941 through December 23rd, inconclusive. Dice kept the 8-day clock until, as an old man, he donated it to a museum in Parkersburg, West Virginia, his hometown. He sent the calendar to Naval Headquarters in Washington. It has never been found. The three sailors were buried in a mass grave with 22 others. That is what officials told Harlan Coston when he journeyed to Honolulu in 1945. In 1949, when the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific was opened, the bodies were discerned and given separate burials. Clifford Ould's remains were shipped home to Stanton. Coston and Edcott were buried in the National Memorial Cemetery in Honolulu, which is commonly referred to as the Punch Bowl. The three stones are identical and have death dates of December 7, 1941. There is unanimous agreement that the death date is unfair in view of the heroic struggle waged by the three young sailors to stay alive.
Now on over to the beautiful, sunny beaches of California, where we will talk about the unidentified serial killer. On January 27th in 1974, a call came in.
I believe there might be a dead person on the beach across from Aloha Street if you follow the street down to the water.
The caller told San Francisco police dispatcher. Didn't give his name, just hung up. The cops rushed down to Ocean Beach, sprawled at the water's edge. About to be washed out by the waves was a man's body. They dragged him back onto the sand and took a close look. He seemed to be about 50 years old, balding, heavy set. 17 stab wounds, front and back, including his hands. He'd tried to fight off his killer. There was no immediate ID on the dead man, but no one had any idea who the killer or the caller might be. They sounded young. Maybe he was just a witness, and maybe he was something more. Nobody knew it that morning, but San Francisco had a brand new serial killer. Something was unknown in these early moments. The beginning to the end of the anonymous man's life had probably just come a few hours before, in one of the city's main gay bars. A handsome young man might have sidled up to him with a sketch, a portrait he had just drawn of him. It was good. The young man may have said something to the effect of, "Hey, let's get out of here." Down to the beach they went. A common spot, then, for hookups. It was late night. Out came the knife. What with the waves and sheltering sand dunes and the time of night, nobody heard the struggle or the screams, if there were any. 44 years later, in May of 2018, a cold case investigator, Dan Cunningham of San Francisco Police Homicide Division, called the Chronicle newsroom and wanted to know how he could find a long-retired Chronicle reporter, Peter Kuhl. "What is this about?" the writer asked. "Murder," he says, "a string of them, actually." Naturally, the reporter began digging into them and found himself consumed with what was probably the biggest and most notorious unsolved serial killing of gay men in California history, if not the nation. The murderer is called the Doodler. He stabbed to death at least 5 gay men in San Francisco over 18 months in the mid-1970s. though the toll might have gone as high as 14. There have been serial killers before and since, but this one wasn't like the others. The doodler snared his victims with his sketches. By all accounts, a good-looking young man with a real artistic skill. He'd stroll into one of the scores of gay bars in Polk Gulch, the Tenderloin, and the Castro. Pick a mark, knock out a quick sketch of the man, show him the doodle, flatter him, suggest they peel away for sex. Next day, the victim turns up dead on a beach or in a park, savagely knifed and slashed over and over. Rage killings. Always in spots known for gay hookups. Despite the efforts of two famous San Francisco homicide detectives, he was never caught. But then, a few years ago, Cunningham joined the cold case unit after a career as an active case homicide inspector. He'd retired not long before, but missed the hunt. One of the first cases he looked into was the doodler. He was stunned. So many gay men killed so long ago, at such a tumultuous time for the LGBTQ plus people seeking justice and freedom. It just struck me, said Cunningham. It needed to be looked into. So he reopened it. That call to the Chronicle was his first steps. Cunningham, who was 62, was searching for the last reporter alive who'd covered the doodler case. That would be Peter Kuhl. Police reports on the 40-plus-year-old murder case were thin, and Cunningham hoped Kuhl had saved his notes from the 1970s. Might be something there. He found Kuhl in a coma in San Francisco in a hospital, suffering from lung cancer. He never woke up, and that ended Cunningham's hopes for his memories or notes. The loneliest man was the man that was found washing into the waves on January 1974. It took a few days for the cops to figure out who he was. Gerald Kavanov, a furniture finisher, possibly at a mattress factory, supposedly from Canada. That was about the extent of the known facts. Kavanov was buried at Holy Cross Catholic Cemetery just down the freeway in Colma. Kavanov's grave marker is a weathered stone plate set flat in a windswept field of grass. You get a lonely feeling just looking at it. Seemed like nobody ever visited. The cemetery office had no information on the occupant. And back to square one. Genealogy sites finally did the trick. They tracked Kavanov's lineage to Montreal, found he was born there in 1923. They hired a freelance researcher in Canada who knocked on doors of relatives who wouldn't answer our letters and calls. The researcher finally found a niece who didn't want to be named, but led us to other relatives, and finally the picture started to color in. Kavanov had left home at a young age and did a 21-month hitch in the U.S. Army at the end of World War II. He wound up in the Haight-Ashbury by the 1970s, presumably to immerse himself into the sexual freedom blossoming there in the nearby Castro. If he was out about being gay, his family was not in on it. He went home once a year to visit his mother until she died in 1967. After that, he never returned. I sort of put two and two together and, well, I have a pretty good idea why he was in San Francisco, said Kavanov's great-nephew, Greg Chin. He's the only relative who would talk beyond a few clipped moments, and he was born 10 years after his great-uncle was killed. But he'd heard plenty of stories. A murder in the family stands out. The family was, quote, fairly Catholic, Chin said, so living openly gay would have definitely been problematic. For Kavanov, planting himself on the West Coast made sense. I'm presuming he was a queer man trying to live, I guess, what I'd imagine a semi-private life in San Francisco, Chin said. Eager for a sense of connection and belonging in a new place, apart from his family. At a time when gay men were being bashed and killed with stultifying regularity. Prime doodler target. It was relatively easy for a killer to go hunting in the mid-1970s. There was little mainstream press coverage of the LGBTQ plus murder victims. A few short pieces appeared when the doodler bodies turned up. A couple of longer pieces later, when it became clear gay men were being stabbed to death at an alarming rate. The Sado murder horror was a splashy headline of a story in January 1976 edition of the Chronicle, 6 months after the last recorded doodler attack. As for Kavanaugh, he got three paragraphs in the Chronicle that never mentioned the word gay, yet that report was followed quickly by a little-noticed homicide squad bulletin that said Kavanaugh appeared to have had homosexual propensities. And that fact eventually made it into the scanty coverage, done better in the city's small gay press. In the end, it just was not big news, even though LGBTQ life was pushing out of the closet and into the public consciousness. Granted, the 1970s were off the charts with a headline grabbing depravity. The zebra killers were offing people all over San Francisco. The Zodiac killer was sending taunting letters to the Chronicle. The Symbionese librarian army snatched Patty Hearst out of her Berkeley apartment. These events sucked the wind out of everything else going on in California. But anti-gay bigotry, even in unusually tolerant San Francisco, added a layer of disregard. Cops were still busting gay people in bars, bushes, and alleys for violating the sodomy laws that weren't repealed in California until 1976. So many gangs of young men took delight in gay bashing that activists, including pioneering LGBTQ champion Harvey Milk, started handing out whistles so victims could call for aid. Police were seen as more hassle than help. Ron Hooverman stated in an article, "People were getting mugged. People were getting harassed. People getting beaten." He came to San Francisco as a young man in the 1970s looking for freedom, and later became the first openly gay investigator for the city's district attorney. "And the doodler took it to another level," he said, "in that he was killing people and getting away with it. Because first of all, the police didn't, to be honest with you, care." No one took Kavanaugh home after his murder. He lies beneath that withered gravestone in Colma, 3,000 miles from Montreal. His nephew, Chen, said Kavanaugh's sister came to San Francisco to identify his body. Apparently, he was so badly mutilated from his defensive wounds that he wasn't even identifiable, he said. Through the years, Chen asked for more information about his great-uncle. Nobody said much. Police records showed Kavanaugh had been stopped by police suspected of having sex in the restrooms known for gay hookups near Ula Street at Beach Ocean. His body was found in the sand a few steps away. The anonymous call to police dispatch that morning, the one that tipped the cops to Kavanaugh's body, came from a payphone at those restrooms. It was the only such call police got on the doodler case. And the cops never figured out if the caller was just a passerby. These were the days before surveillance cameras, before DNA swabs, and even before people dialed 911 to report something terrible. Another case that happened just a few years prior was shockingly similar to this one. Jay Stevens did a terrific Julie Andrews, and he was funny as hell. In 1974, he was a rising San Francisco drag queen, wowing crowds at the PS Lounge in Polk Gulch and world-famous Finocchio's in North Beach. Jay Stevens was this bright young, I would guess in his early 20s, pretty boy, said Kirk Frederick, longtime assistant to drag star Charles Pierce and a chronicler of those days. Charming kid. With makeup and hair and costume and, you know, the fake corset and all that, he was a strikingly beautiful woman. Looks weren't all, though. Stevens was a triple threat on stage. Great singer, dancer, and as Frederick said, a really good stand-up comic in a dress. A Bay Area reporter once wrote that Stevens had, quote, a face that launched a thousand sailors, high cheekbones, long wavy hair the color of straw, and eyes like a doe. For all that pizzazz, Jay was not arrogant. For someone as open and gregarious and funny on stage, he was really very soft-spoken, Frederick said. Very quiet, very demure, very modest. You would give him a compliment, and he would almost turn away in embarrassment. That all ended on June 25th of 1974. His given name was Joseph, and that's how he was listed on the police report when his body was found beside a tree at Spreckles Lake by a woman out for an early morning stroll in Golden Gate Park. He'd last been seen in the Cabaret Club in North Beach, where he'd once again wowed the crowds with his wisecrack, singing and dancing. Like Kavanaugh, he'd been savagely stabbed, front and back, beaten so badly that his family was barely able to recognize his corpse. Eventually, reporters got a hit on a niece of Stevens in Holland, and she had her own horror story. Turned out, Stevens had a sister, Alma Teresa Stevens, who thought evil spirits had emerged from his murder. 3 months after his death, she dismembered their mother and burned her in the family fireplace in Concord, then took a sledgehammer to her sister's head. The sister survived. Oh my gosh. Alma ended up in an institution for the criminally insane. While there, she had a daughter. That daughter was the niece we found in Europe. Soon after the sledgehammer attack, and after Alma Stevens was arrested, their father burned to death in an office fire. Alma's institutionalization process was involved and stressful. The trauma eventually drove Honrath away from the Bay Area. She came back only after her murderous sister died in 2004. This 70-year-old woman hadn't talked about her brother in decades. She hadn't talked to police since the day she ID'd the body. But that day, when she recalled the past, she lit up. Yes, Stevens did a terrific Julie Andrews, but not a lot more. Not lip-syncing either. His voice was electric, honey. Sometimes Stevens did comedy solo, sometimes in a trio. If he'd lived, the sky would have been his limit, she said. He was very talented, very, very talented, and again, gorgeous. Oh my, we had such fun together, making up little shows while he was growing up and then later on in the clubs. I mean, he was a fantastic actor. And oh, he could sing. In fact, Honrath sang and danced with her brother and a comedian named Steve Miller, who was well known at the time. They called themselves the Wonder Sisters. She was the female relief, she said with a laugh, before singing a snippet of Baby Let the Good Times Roll. They were getting ready to leave for a gig in Boston when her brother was killed. She eventually became a nurse. I miss him to this day, she said. I've had a good life, but I would like to have Joe's case solved. I think it was just pushed aside, you know? Another gay, unworthy person murdered, you know? What's with this guy? Is he around? Is he alive? This doodler guy? Little did she know, the answer to that question was probably yes.